So, I don't have any disclosures. It's not on my PowerPoint, but I forgot about putting that in there, but there's no disclosures. So I'll be talking about building the power of women of color-led organizations in order to build health justice in the South and beyond. And for me, it's really important when we talk about this to really start this conversation and grounding it in history. That means that we're starting off with the history of institutionalized racism, including in healthcare, and where people of color, women, LGBTQ folks are the original folks who've been left out. And they've been left out of healthcare access for centuries. And as a matter of fact, some of you may know and or remember that experiments were done on enslaved black women in the 1850s that really led to the gynecology methods that we are using and talking about today. Intentionally denying medical access to around 400 black folks who had syphilis in Tuskegee, Alabama between 1932 and 1972. And by the way, this was something that the U.S. Government also did, similar to in Guatemala. They had sex workers with, this is not what my facts said, but I changed the word because I am pro-sex work. So they had sex workers that had syphilis, and they let them go out into the world without curing them and infecting Guatemalan men. And then they decided, after they had 1,500 people who were infected, they were like, oh, we're not going to give you penicillin. We want to wait and see to see how this goes out. So it's not just here, right? The imperialism of the U.S., as we might know, goes broad outside of our walls here. And then, of course, forced sterilization that happened to Puerto Rican women without their knowledge or by making them believe that this was a reversible thing. This was part of population control that became institutionalized in 1937. And of course, it didn't end there. We also did it to women in the California prison systems, and this came to light a few years ago. So really, this is where we're starting off. And then to add on to that layer, we also are basing our healthcare system, it's largely employer-based, you all probably know that, which means that it's basically at the whim of the potential type of employer that one might have. And according to the U.S. Census, the likelihood of employer-provided healthcare increases if an individual is a high-wage earner, they are employed full-time, and or they work for certain business sectors. Which, another way to read that is, it's already stacking the debt in favor for some and putting a huge wedge for others. Folks of color, communities of color, have higher rates of unemployment. They're likelier to work in part-time jobs and or in sectors that are typically don't provide health insurance, like construction, service, fast food workers, retail industries. In these low-wage jobs means that people have to have one, two, three part-time jobs or two and an extra gig, you know, trying to piecemeal things together, which obviously means that having access or money to potentially see a doctor is just out of the possibility for a lot of folks. This, as we you all know, contributes to poor health status, higher rates of chronic illnesses, death, including maternal death for women of color, and then we have what I like to call the cycle of violence. And unfortunately, I use this term for a lot of things that have to deal with institutionalized racism, with just day racism that we see and experience in everyday life. It's the cycle of violence, and it's hard to break. So now that we've had that as a starting point, let's fast forward to 2012. Where Cindy mentioned conservative pushback challenged ACA in the Supreme Court, and ACA was upheld in the summer of 2012. You might recognize some folks on the picture there. And this was a bittersweet victory, right? Because healthcare advocates, this was huge as one component was upheld, the ACA, but then in another end, Medicaid, expanding Medicaid was left up to the state. It was made optional, which Cindy mentioned earlier. So it was kind of a bittersweet victory. And you all maybe have seen this before. But historically, as you Medicaid eligibility has been restricted to low-income individuals in a specific category with very specific low incomes. It varies throughout the states, throughout every single state. So it just makes it kind of a hodgepodge and a very puzzled piece to really kind of dive into. And in this new post-ACA era, we're now dealing with a constant, ever-present gap of uninsured, low-income women, LGBTQ folks, and their families due to the lack of action of one person in their state. And Cindy showed this map, but basically, for me, this map is a representation of the legacy of institutionalized racism continuing, right? The current strategy of many conservative governors to refuse to close the gap is part of their anti-ACA stance, and it's also part of their electoral strategy, right? You know, they're now moving away from talking about it in one very in-your-face method to moving to talking about it in other softer methods. And, you know, really, like, some of the similarities between the states I'm going to talk about a little bit, but you can see that some of them are rural, they're really big, they're diverse in terms of the population of folks that are there, and now 3 million adults are in a coverage gap because they live in a state where their governor has refused to expand. And to really talk a little bit more about who's in the gap, several states that have expanded, we can say that a lot of them have higher Hispanic or Latino populations. Other states with large African American populations like Georgia, Mississippi, Louisiana are not. And therefore, we can conclude, obviously, that the African American community remains a huge share of the population that falls in the gap, with the Latino community falling right behind, as you can see, which means that 56% of the folks that are falling in the gap continue to be folks of color. And just to go a little bit more into that and into the specifics of the states, people that fall into the gap are concentrated in states with the largest uninsured populations. You know, A equals B or 1 + 1 = 2. They are in a small number of states, and more than half live in just 3 states, in Texas, Florida, and Georgia, my current home state. And just to talk a little bit about regionally, you know, the South is where more uninsured people live. The South has more restrictions around Medicaid eligibility. And there's also 11 out of the 20 states that have not expanded are all in the South, which means that it's us Southerners that are being left out. We make up 90% of the population of the folks that are being left out of the coverage gap. And also to talk a little bit about LGBTQ population, LGBTQ folks, as you can see there, 48% live in the South. 1 in 3 is uninsured. 67% of LGBTQ folks have been without health insurance for 2 years or more. This was done a couple of years ago. It was a couple of years ago. And as you can see, 41% are underneath the 139% level of the federal poverty level. And I mean, this, I think for me, the way when I look at this, I add a little extra, because there's a lot of people that are falling in the LGBTQ community that either don't identify or that we just don't catch to be able to catch them in these statistics. And so really, I always like to add a little extra oomph to these numbers. So just think of this as like the very basic baseline. I'll be switching it soon for the picture taker. And then more than half, 57%, are folks that are working. They have jobs. There's so many messed up talking points out there that are talking about, oh, all these people don't have jobs, which is all a bunch of lies. 57% are folks that are working, but like I said earlier, they are uninsured because they work part-time jobs, they work for an employer that doesn't provide it. I mean, these things, I think, they make sense to me, but I guess, you know, my logic doesn't apply generally to governors or, you know, other folks. And Families USA did a really amazing breakdown of kind of the categories and the industries that people lie in. And they have a number of states on their website in all of the job, like the industries that people are in are all the same, right? Construction, fast food, retail, your lawn person, like those, it just varies by state how much, where the percentages lie. But in addition to the very real and artificial barriers, i.e. the governor saying, no, we're not going to expand, there's also other structural barriers that we're dealing with, right? For immigrants, if you're undocumented and you don't have any, and if you're undocumented, you have zero access to marketplace plans. Even if you wanted to pay a full amount, premium, say you had the money ready to go, you couldn't do it. If you're DACA or Deferred Action Childhood Arrival, you are here, quote unquote, legitimately, you're able to pay in state tuition, you may be able to get a driver's license. Oh, but if you want health insurance, no, just kidding, you can't get any. Also, there's other language access barriers, right? Not enough people on the 1-800 phone line, application process being difficult to kind of maneuver, not enough navigators that speak Spanish, let alone any of the other languages that folks speak here in the U.S. Also, folks living with HIV, the cost for premiums is too high for people. It's outside of their financial reach. I think someone mentioned it earlier, but accessing medication is out of reach also because they're placing HIV medication in higher tiers and other, also medication to other chronic illnesses is being placed in higher tiers, which means it costs more, which means you don't have access to it. And so you're either having to do a wine and right combo if you're lucky. For folks that have been formerly incarcerated, if they had Medicaid before going in, the states are terminating that Medicaid as opposed to suspending it. When you get out, you have no housing, you have no job, you have no health care. And as mentioned earlier, health literacy, if you do get a card in your hand, if you do get a plan, because it's such a cultural shift to really learn how to go take care of yourself, in a way that is preventative. There's a lot of health literacy that needs to happen with our communities, especially, I mean, when I say with our communities, I'm referring to low-income, women of color, LGBTQ folks. And what we're trying to do is one thing to address that. But in general, these are some tough barriers to really try to overcome, and I think RWB and our regional coordinators are making it happen. And for us, it's important to really center and support women of color groups that are led by women of color themselves, to connect them directly, to facilitate those relationships, to increase organizational capacity so that they can have more skills and continue to grow in their leadership abilities. And these are just some of the folks that we work with. The work isn't always easy, it's not always fast moving, and it's definitely not immune to challenges. And one thing that's a continuous challenge, as Cindy mentioned earlier, is that as we get closer to the possibility of expanding Medicaid, especially in the South, a lot of our regional coordinators and the coalitions that they're working with are having to have tough discussions around where are we going to draw the line in the sand in terms of Medicaid waivers, as you now heard. Very, very exciting topics. You know, but really, it's a crucial topic because it's what's going to continue to leave our folks behind. It's going to continue to leave folks out of reach. And so at what point do you draw the line and say, we want Medicaid for this many, and it's still going to end up leaving these other folks out? Which is a super difficult conversation to have in coalitions. And this is something that the folks that are going to be left out are going to continue and further be exasperated because of, remember the first slide? All of that's already there, and you're just adding, compiling more to folks and to communities. And in the Deep South, it's hard enough to have some of our own folks being recognized as worthy human beings because we're LGBT or because we're queer or trans, or if you're a woman with living with HIV. And this is a real challenge that's also happening even sometimes within our own advocate circles, right? Having to have these conversations in ways that isn't continuing to further some of these like racist notions and ideas that folks have. And so we're working with Southern our season also in the Southwest to build their organizational capacity through a project called Working Against the Grain, which is what I'm working on with Billy, so that they can remain in their communities, obviously not just for the benefit of RWV, but more importantly for the benefit of their own community. So some of the organizations that we're working with are super small. They have either one staffer or volunteer staffers, and really trying to work with them to implement what they need to institutionalize themselves and have a little bit of a better grounding and be able to apply the grants, be able to do things besides just kind of piecing things together, whether it's with us or some of the other work that they're doing. And I'm only going to talk about three lessons learned. I kind of put this picture together and it really centers my three lessons learned. It was really fun putting this one together specifically. Basically, you know, the one big thing is that these fights and projects are long term, right? There isn't going to be a win in 1 year. There isn't going to be a win in some other short period of time, which I've said this to funders before, trying to drive that point across to say, there needs to be investments in people, there needs to be investments in infrastructure, there needs to be investments in the organizing that is happening so that folks can build toward this long-term fight. Change is hard, change is slow, and this is true not only for organizations that are trying to become sustainable in their capacity building. This is something we've learned in the Working Against the Grain project, but this is obviously also true in our own advocacy work, as we've seen in this long Medicaid expansion fight. Which again points to the long-term investments that are needed. And finally, I think that we really have to start thinking about ACA and covering the remaining uninsured beyond the initial access point that ACA has provided. And what I mean, it's almost like doing a two-pronged strategy, right? One, we have to fix the existing holes that exist in ACA, right? Network adequacy, affordability issues, those things need to get fixed. But I think we also have to talk about and figure out how we provide and ease access to millions who continue to be left out, right? To folks that are, I think someone mentioned it in one of the presentations that I was at earlier, is like there continues to be a huge number of folks that their access is either decreasing or is going away because of ACA changes, right? Community health centers, some folks are having to switch, which is great in some way for the folks, the newly insured, but then that continues to further leave behind communities and people, like my mom, who's undocumented, who's like, ACA what? I don't know, I can't still do that, you know? And so there still continues to be that huge gap. And in Arizona, this person in the middle is Ana Castillo, who's a queer person in Arizona. And one of the organizations that we're working with is has opened up an LGBT migrant clinic, and they're helping 100 LGBTQ migrant folks that are undocumented to have access to healthcare. The toolkit. The other reason why I'm up here is, just to wrap up with this, one of the other things that I'm working on besides trying to translate the health guide into Spanish is a toolkit to really be able to provide support to our regional coordinators to talk about Medicaid expansion in a different way. I think both community members and advocates are starting to get a little fatigued about, oh, we've got to expand Medicaid, oh, but no one's listening, no? And community folks are also like, okay, I'm done and tired of listening. But there's still a lot of people that don't know about this. And this toolkit that we're working on that hopefully will be available soon, it's going to have fact sheets that really center the voices of women, women of color, LGBTQ folks, samples, templates, letters to the editor, op-eds, a guide on how to put a town hall together, a facilitator guide on putting together house parties or office parties, to really walk you through the planning and the facilitating of it and really be able to talk about these things in what we hope will be a very easy digestible method. So if any of you will live in a state where we have regional coordinators, I'm happy to connect you to help get the party started, hey, or to have you all do your own, and I'm happy to work with folks to be able to do that. And this is a picture of our regional coordinators that I'll leave up for the Q&A, but those are some of the folks we're working with. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cecilia. Okay, we finished early on purpose, so that we have time for discussion. And just if you could holler out, and if you're leaving now, if you haven't gotten information, our booth is 1909, or you're not leaving but you couldn't get, you know, something that we ran out of, 1909 will be there tomorrow. We have copies of everything we have. So that hand went up, you, and if you could just speak loud enough so everyone could hear.
One question and two comments. I'm an internist who retired a year ago in New York, just at the moment when before ACA patients could start coming. But I was there long enough to get some very disturbing pieces of mail from the insurance companies. I don't know if you're aware of this or if it's changed. There were two big companies in my area, Blue Shield and Healthcare. I don't even remember which is which. But one of them said, you're excluded, you're not allowed to take, you won't be allowed to take patients under this plan, which happened to many doctors in my area. The other one said, you will be receiving one half of the payment for ACA patients as for private patients that we cover. So, of course, there was a tremendous disincentive for doctors not to participate if they had the choice, and there were several other provisions that made it unpalatable. So I don't know if this has changed, and I found that most people are unaware of it, whether they're patients or people who are advocates like yourself. So I don't know if it's changed if you're aware of it. But the comments are that your wonderful information bulletin seems to me to be as necessary for men as women. So I'm not quite sure what the purpose of is of labeling in a way that might turn men off from looking at it, because men are even usually more ignorant about healthcare than women. And my last comment is that as helpful as ACA has been to people, we should never forget that basically it was a gift to the private insurance companies. Identical to a plan that CNHP says that was developed by insurance companies a long time ago, that they would be wishing it would be put into effect to force everybody to buy insurance from them. So that as all this wonderful organizing is being done, I hope at the same time we remind people that that's what it is, and we need something entirely different, and using all this context to help organize people to demand, you know, a single payer benefit.
Right, so thanks for your great feedback. Of course, men need literacy help, and the guide is designed for women so we could use women-specific examples and talk about fibroids and, you know, your well woman visit. You know, if someone wants to get out there and learn from us and use our model for men, more power to them. But your comment and question about that the ACA is a gift to insurers is, yeah, it is built on the existing system, and the existing system was built on private insurance, and it is unsustainable, but our response to it is to press to make it better. Pressing on affordability is going to bring, at some point, some collision between insurers' wish to keep people from accessing services, which can possibly be lying behind what you experienced as, oh, guess what, if you stay in, you'll get an unsustainably low payment. Or, you know, so we push on affordability, and Lois is sort of inching to get up to say we push on provider access. So both of those, all those ways in which you've picked out what's wrong, we are trying to respond to in the here and now.
We hope the guide is useful to men, but we have focused on women not only because we're raising women's voices, focusing on women and women's health, but because we know that when you educate a woman about how to use health insurance, you're helping the whole family, right? So we believe the information will get to men. We hope it will. After the situation you mentioned in New York, there are definitely problems with the provider networks of many of the health plans in New York and in other states. And that's why we're doing that network adequacy research. We will be able to demonstrate, I'm fairly sure, within a short period of time, that New York needs to crack down on these health plans and do something about the inadequacy of the provider networks. Now, how the insurance plans will go about getting more doctors could involve paying them more, right? or giving them other enticements. We'll see, but we definitely need stronger standards and stronger enforcement of those standards.
More questions, comments, suggestions? Yeah.
So Align of Care was actually an interesting one. So an example of where the printed information didn't align with what we got from the call center. So we couldn't find information about IUDs in the Align of Care formulary, so we called to find out whether they covered any. And when we called, we were told, oh, Align of Care covers all FDA-approved birth control. We said, yeah, the methods, but like the product, could you let us know which of these products you cover? The woman on the call center said, nope, we cover all of them. ACA says we cover all of them, we cover all of them. So we actually went into our Align Eye Care meetings with all green, and they said, well, this is lovely, but that's not true. So they actually changed for the worse, but that's because we got bad information. And we went into that knowing that it was likely not true, and we had long conversations with them. I think the other thing that's interesting about Align Eye Care, they did, the one thing I know for sure that they didn't cover before that they did add was Ella. And a lot of other plans were doing that because of the change in the rule, but they had started before that because one of our partner organizations, also Raising Women's Voices Regional Coordinator out in Washington State and out Northwest Health Law Advocates, had done a similar review and talked with their parent company, Centene. And so they're making a nationwide policy change.
More questions? Yes.
Just want to remember that some people listen to the presentations afterwards, and so if we're at the mic, they'll get to hear this part of it too.
So the question is, what existing efforts are going with civil rights and other LGBT organizations, and what have been some challenges as well? Okay, great. So a lot of the work, so the regional coordinators are the ones kind of more on the ground doing some of this. I think it varies by state. So in Georgia, Feminist Women's Health Center, they worked with Moral Monday in the past, and Moral Monday did actions in the Capitol, ended up getting arrested. A lot of the folks that were involved in that were part from the civil rights kind of era folks. Feminist Women's Health Center also works very closely with LGBTQ organizations in Atlanta. So it's kind of like it changes by state, right? In Mississippi, it's been very hard because Mississippi, our regional coordinator there, is focused on women living with HIV and LGBTQ folks, Mississippi in Action. And the challenge there is that, you know, like I said earlier, like folks don't want to see us as human beings, whether if we're LGBTQ, right? Or if we're, if you're a woman living with HIV. And unfortunately, you know, sometimes the civil rights folks can be heavy on the church end, you know, very respectfully, and have a lot of challenges being accepting of those communities, which then means that they have challenges trying to work together. So then in Mississippi, you have to figure out, okay, who else can I work with that either in the church or sometimes outside of the church to really try to bring some awareness to this. In Louisiana, folks are not working with civil rights folks there. They are, Women with a Vision is really working with sex workers, incarcerated folks, and really doing outreach in the streets. They've kind of just carved out their own way, and I think it's because of the history that they've had in Louisiana. They've been around for 25 years, and they at times collaborate. We have two regional coordinators there, just to kind of balance out and really try to reach as many folks as possible. And so they sometimes collaborate with one another. In Tennessee, we just brought someone on board who actually has a huge group of clergy folks that they're training and doing work with. So I think there's going to be some positive church connections. So it really just varies, especially in the South. And I hope that answered both what's happening and the challenges.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Sure.
Because working in the South, I'm Alabama.
Yeah.
Working in the South is difficult.
Sure,
so
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe in Mississippi, if I was to kind of speak for Valencia, but I mean, I think other than that, not really, actually. I think folks, and the one similarity that everyone has is that you have someone that's going to fall in the gap, whether they are, you know, in the civil rights movement and have been a supporter, whether they go to church and, you know, are low income, straight, working at fast food, trying to make it, you know, figure it out. So there's definitely things that overlap there. It's just the advocacy working together. And sometimes, and people, not to say that people aren't doing their own work, it just may not be connected with us and with the regional coordinators. Yeah.
I think we have time for maybe one more question, comment.
Okay, to close it out, I want to say thank you for your attention, your interest. I want to remind you that if you want more materials that we're out of, come by the booth. It'll be there all tomorrow morning, 1909. Wherever that red clipboard is, if someone could hold it up. It's fabulous. Thank you. We would love to talk more right now with any of you on one-on-one. And we have our handy dandy scanner here. So if any of you want an electronic follow-up about the guide or about any other work we're doing, just come up and let one of us scan your badge real quick, and that'll automatically get you connected with the resources that Lois and others showed. And the only other thing I'd request is our this program brought to you by sponsor, the Women's Caucus, would love a picture of the panel so they can post on their Facebook. I saw you taking off. Great. So many, many thanks to all of you for being with us, and happy to continue the conversation now or later.
Thank you.